Hello and welcome to the 1913 Lockout podcast series. I'm your host, Moira Murphy. This week's show looks at the state of media in Ireland, what role both the mainstream and radical media have played historically and today. We'll be speaking to James Redmond and Paul Reynolds of Rabble magazine and Henry Silk of the Critical Media Review blog. We'll also be looking at the connection between Jim Larkin's main opponent during the lockout, William Martin Murphy, and his contemporary, Denis O'Brien, both controllers of the Irish Independent. But first up, we have a clip taken from a recent event organised by Rabble, where journalist Harry Brown and historian Conor McCabe talk about the issues concerning contemporary journalism and look at some examples of the history of a radical press in Ireland.
I've got a real romantic attachment to this tradition of the radical press, and I always get excited whenever I see a new version of it, you know, 2.0, 3.0, whatever trendy terminology we want to use for it. I love that kind of, that even as you get into the kind of 20th century, the party media and that sort of dirty old joke about how the lower organs of the party must penetrate the backward sections of the proletariat, and that is a tremendous kind of energy and sense of movement, and the idea that papers themselves are the carrier of movement. They identify the movement is there because of the paper. Is that still true? Can we talk about it anymore? Some of you probably saw, I think it's about 6 years ago now, Regis Debray had a piece in the New Left Review, which was called "Socialism: A Life Cycle," and it was about partly a kind of wallowing in the wonders of the great era of radical papers, radical books that seemed like they could eliminate all wage slavery from the world forever. And when the idea the phrase "let it go to press, pass to press" was as good as open fire, you know, that printing was the route to liberation. But but Debray also suggests that we're no longer in that era. He calls that the era of the, I think it's the logosphere, the world of the word, of seduction rather than persuasion, of the visual rather than the verbal, and that this sets limits on what we can achieve in terms of liberation through the word. And of course we have technical limits that are being set. So whether or not we're working on screens or in print, Rabble, for instance, prints on newsprint. Will there even be a printer in Dublin or in Ireland in 5 or 10 years' time that will be able to do that sort of work?
This is the newspaper itself. That's the voice of Labour. That was the thing. Help banks make unemployment. Could you picture a headline today saying banks make unemployment? Banks are the innovators, are the entrepreneurs? And incredible stuff that's going on. And this is the front cover of that issue. The voice of Labour, 6th of October 1923, National Prosperity. And it's out there and reads that a capitalist like politician, Ireland is not a capitalist country. Have you ever heard ever even used that phrase for Ireland? Small open economy is what used. As if it's a bloody Sassuma, you know? Sacrifices must be made in the interests of national prosperity. The world turns, but things just stay the same. This was another cover of the Voice of Labour. Sowing the wind, the ballot box, if you get what you choose, on strike, and it's going to the head. Because in 1922 and in 1923, the Free State Army was being used to smash strikes. That's what they would do. They used the army to shut down strikes. Again, this has been covered, and we can cover this now as historians, because it was covered in the independent media 90 years ago. Those stories are the reason why we can talk about it even now. This is from The Worker's Voice in 1935. Only when Harry said it, I realized I actually have left out Irish Worker and Jim Larkin. It's quite incredible. I just thought, dope! but the paper is worth, but no talking about, because Jim Larkin in 1911 was not getting a fair crack of the whip in the Irish Independent, so he set up his own newspaper. He didn't hold a conference in Vince Hotel saying, the media aren't our friends. He set up his own newspaper and he made it a mass circulation newspaper as well. By using the same, he was constantly being sued. Yeah, fuck him, he said. You know? So that was there as well. Is that if they throw a punch at you, you throw one back, you know? But this is Day Workers' Voice from 1935. Can you see the headline story? We demand open inquiry into scandal of the Artane tragedy. They were covering the deaths in Artane Boys' School in 1935, calling for full inquiries into those deaths. In this poor case, the kid had been kicked to death. The father who lived in, what's that street now? It's off St. Stephen's Green. It's next to the Royal College of Surgeons. It used to be
York Street. No.
That's right.
York Street.
It was in kind of York Street, right? So he called down to pick up to see his like son's body in the morgue down on down by Ambien Street. And they let him see his body, and then we saw the body. They couldn't even cover it up because he saw all the bruises. Like they said that he died of some illness. He says he did not die of any illness. Couldn't go to the press. He just weren't interested. So he went to the Workers' Voice and they printed his story and called for an inquiry. So already we're 12, 13 years into the free state, and already how banking works and the extent of abuse in this country are already being covered by independent media. And this is what was going on at this time, covered by this. Now the Workers' Voice, as you can see by the hammer and sickle, actually says that this is the organ of the Communist Party of Ireland. But they were covering this story. Now, in the later issues, this had such a resonance that there are people who were, there was one guy who was in Australia, and he'd read then the story, and he wrote a letter in about his experience of it then as well. So this is being covered. Again, independent media, that's its role.
During the time of the 1913 lockout, the wealthy William Martin Murphy was the controller of the Irish Independent. Today, in 2013, multi-millionaire Dennis O'Brien is the controller of the Irish Independent, as well as radio stations News Talk, Today FM, Dublin 98, Spin 103.8 and Spin Southwest. The commonalities, however, do not end there. William Martin Murphy and Dennis O'Brien can be counted among some of the most successful Irish businessmen of the last century. As well as the Irish Independent, William Martin Murphy owned and controlled much of the Irish Railways and Dublin's Tramway. As well as being controller of the Irish Independent, Dennis O'Brien was chairman of ESAT Digifone, one of the largest telecommunications providers in Ireland, the founder of Communicore, one of the largest media holding companies in Ireland, and Ergo, one of the largest aircraft companies in the world. But big business tends to go hand in hand with controversy, and neither Murphy or O'Brien were strangers to this. As already seen in this podcast series, William Martin Murphy is one of the primary opponents and organiser of employers against Larkin and Connolly during the 1913 lockout, and according to some, held a strong aversion to union building. In August 2001, over 4,000 Aircom staff signed a petition against the selling of Aircom to O'Brien's E-Ireland consortium, citing a lack of confidence in his ability to manage Aircom in the best interest of the country, the staff, or the company. The reputation of O'Brien, as with Martin Murphy, clearly preceded him. However, O'Brien's reputation was not more tarnished than by the findings of the second report of the Moriarty Tribunal in 2011. O'Brien was found to have been assisted to the tune of thousands of euro by Communications Minister of the time, Michael Lowry, in accessing a heavily sought-after mobile phone licence in Ireland for O'Brien's company ESAT. Murphy could be said to have courted political interests for personal gain, though a self-proclaimed staunch nationalist most distinctly manifested in his refusal to accept a knighthood from the King of England. A comment in 1916 may reveal that such a desire for home rule was generated simply from the experience of having his business premises burnt down by the fire of British troops suppressing a rebellion in the streets of Dublin, something he never wanted to see repeated. Were Murphy's nationalist tendencies, as with O'Brien's apparent allegiance to Fine Gael, then motivated not by real political and societal interest, but instead by pure self-interest? The answers to such questions are open to debate. However, what is clear is that both William Martin Murphy and Dennis O'Brien possessed and possessed still considerable control over the Irish media. Use of the Irish Independent for Murphy's political interests is well documented. Full editorials in favour of Home Rule and influence on the paper as a whole is thought to have been one of the most potent agencies in terms of breaking down the Irish Party and opening the door for Sinn Féin. Positive or negative, though this may have been, what is clear is that one of the richest and worker rights opposed men in Dublin was taking the reins here, and not the poor or the workers. Elements of editorial control appear to be at play within the Irish Independent today as well. According to leaked memos from Independent News and Media, the Irish Independent journalist Sam Smith was effectively silenced in 2011 from reporting on O'Brien's involvement in the Moriarty Tribunal. Another Irish Independent article detailing Anglo-Irish Bank's biggest borrowers has also been suggested to have been sought to be quashed by O'Brien. Such allegations lead broadcaster and journalist Vincent Brown to proclaim that he does not believe Dennis O'Brien to be a fit person to be allowed control of the country's second most powerful media enterprise.
We're talking about media, and today with us we have myself, Shane Fitzgerald from Unfinished Business.
Alan Dunn from Unfinished Business.
James Redman from Rabble Magazine.
Paul Reynolds from Rabble as well.
Henry Silk from Critical Media Review and various other blogs.
So
as far as I can see, in terms of alternative media, there's quite a lot going on now, and there's a bit of a renaissance in it. You've got Rabble being very successful, putting out a really good product. You've got Look Left doing the same thing, and there's various other small things going on, and there's a lot of good blogs with quality writing. So I think there has been a big change over the last few years, which is very positive.
Yeah. Does anyone kind of remember what it was like in the 90s? Like when the Celtic Tiger was kicking off, would that be in anyone's collective memory?
Well, when did indie media start?
2001.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'd probably take more of a contrarian view on it, and I think that it's kind of it's a signal of how weak things are on the left or within community media or alternative media, that we think the few ventures that are doing stuff today are a signal of strength. Where even if you think back to 2001. That kind of post anti-capitalist movement period, you need a website like Indie Media getting 250,000 hits a month.
Wow.
You had free magazines like The Slate on the street.
Mm.
So I think it depends what you want to measure yourself against. I mean, Look Left is out monthly, Rabble's out. We haven't printed since November of last year. I wouldn't really see that as strength. I think there's kind of things are blossoming, but we still have quite a long way to go with them.
Yeah, massive amounts of work that has to be done because it is weak. Not like to completely criticise what Henry's saying, but there's small ventures now, and we haven't like become anything as large as we should be.
Yeah, David Simon's written a lot about this as well. I mean, this sense that voluntary media is great and it's wonderful, and I wasn't trying to be too positive, but there is thing that voluntary media doesn't do. It doesn't go to a court and hang around a court for 10 hours a day.
Mm.
It doesn't go to a council office and hang around a council office 10 hours a day.
Mm.
It can't do that without funding, you know. So we still have that mainstream is although it looks like it's weak, it's still quite strong in other ways.
Institutionally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and there is always a way that the wealthy have always been willing to subsidize a media, you know, that they newspapers are never money making, really. I don't think in any period, you know. So they were always, you know, as a weapon of power to be used by people with the funding to propose them. So just contradict myself completely.
But then on the other side, you've kind of like our media, and we don't have those kind of resources whatsoever. So like you're saying, that we can't go and hang around the court all day. So maybe that kind of comes into the thing where it's not actually as strong, you know. I think social media and, you know, the way print is kind of falling away kind of lends to maybe an illusion that our media, it's easier to start up, easier to get going, but it's harder to maybe get that quality because it's not being paid for and have that kind of reach and have that kind of depth and research and the real kind of work on the ground. So the people who do kind of volunteering to do that, it's quite a lot to take on, and these groups and collectives and media mags and free sheets, they kind of might be a bit disadvantaged. So maybe Henry might be and yourselves and everyone would write that. It's not completely...
You'll find a lot of the, what we call citizen journalism, we'll say now, for want of a term just there too. A lot of it tends to be reactionary as well. An example of that would be kind of going on from what Henry was saying about Reuters. The Times, the Irish Times and RT both used Reuters' article on what's happening in Istanbul.
Mm.
And it was pretty much copy and paste. And it was just horrifically wrong. It had everything... at such a slant from the reality that it might have been actually produced in the president's office. It was just an awful piece.
Yeah.
And it was laughed at on social media, you know.
Mm.
And we have the two lads over there that have been sending us reports, and they're in charge of our Twitter at the moment, you know.
Mm.
And you can see now that there's, you know, genuinely good reporters are even talking with the boys now, because they've been on the ground since the beginning, since before it kicked off over there. They were doing a blog for us about the park before it really had become up.
The editor of Liberty, actually, what's his name, he dug up this quote where he actually said that to Forbes magazine that he had control of major newspapers in Ireland, therefore when he asked for things, they tended to happen for him. So when he went looking for the oil, He got the planning for the oil things.
Licensing,
that's the word, yeah.
Yeah.
So there is that element. But just to come back to, because it made a point there, the reason I was kind of saying there's been a bit of a flourishing of media, I think the quality of the alternative media out now is really good. The stuff coming back from Istanbul is brilliant by any standard. It's better than anything in the mainstream media by a long way. You know, not even the Reuters thing, but it's much, much better. The quality looks better.
Mm.
The writing is much better. The layout is really good, and this is across a lot of these things.
And maybe you could tell us a bit about the model, you know, how Rebel works, because it's not traditional. You know, none of them really are traditional. There's quite a heavy social media element, maybe a bit less on, you know, regular publications, kind of Rebel's quarterly.
We aim for a quarterly newspaper, but as I was saying, we haven't published since November, so we use social media to kind of maintain a dialogue with our readers in that kind of fallow period.
Mm.
I think one of the things about doing a radical newspaper as well is that you sort of have to invert your process of production. Say with Socialist Workers, the SP's paper, or magazines or newspapers like that, they have a message that they want to bring out to people, where I think what we try and do is reflect the concerns and desires of our audience in the paper, and that allows the magazine to grow with the audience, to become radical with the audience, and to be more embedded within kind of the community that's been built around it.
Yeah, and it helps kind of create a collective identity, you know, for the city and, you know, the Rebel.
Yeah, I mean, it's not by accident really, like, either that a name like Rebel was chosen.
Mm.
It was to try and create kind of a counter-hegemonic identity that people could kind of seize onto via mapping out various kind of struggles or sources of inspiration or cultural movements that you could definitely say were on this side of the fence rather than that side of the fence.
The stories that you cover as well, like things like rent, things like housing and landlords and stuff, they're quite central to, like, Irish, you know, working class kind of fighting tradition and going on back. But you don't really see all that much of it.
Is that the physicality of the artefact reaches audiences that online material won't.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I know, for instance, our online audience definitely comes from the fact that we do send bundles down to Limerick and so on. We'd be just in a Dublin online ghetto among a few people who like to party at the weekend if we weren't actually shipping bundles out all around the country. So I think they kind of go hand in hand, really.
Mm.
It's funny, for a time, London was our second city on our stats.
Really?
Yeah. So I haven't looked at that way, the breakdown demographics.
That's the Nick Griffin thing, though.
Well, no, I mean, it's still quite high, so we've got
a
lot of it, yeah.
Mm.
And, you know, Scots and things like that as well. It's diaspora, I suppose, really, you know, mostly now.
Yeah.
And it's harder for us to get the stuff out to them, but we do ship.
Mm.
We do ship Rebel overseas as well.
Where this has come from, where the sources come from. You know, if you look, for example, at the student riots, where did all the information come from, the last student riots? The police. you know, everything. Yeah. And if you looked at, I looked at every news broadcast from that, and it was all, you know, student hits policeman baton with head sort of stories. You know, police were attacked. And what was really interesting with that story was this came, all the channels were, you know, talking about how the students attacked the police. And funnily enough, about then the real footage got onto YouTube and people saw what was really happening. And I think it got about 90,000 hits, the footage. And then RT came back a week later to the day. But the news story was there's been all these hits on YouTube. Not that police have done whatever, but the news story, oh, look at this YouTube thing is really popular. And then what was really interesting, what they said at the end of it was, but some of this footage is from RT. Begging the question, why didn't you show it in the first place then?
Yeah,
so it completely, so it shows where the agency comes from there, like with people with camera phones and everything.
Yeah.
But
do you think there's a perhaps a split happening in, say, Irish media between, like, say, your kind of rural Marian Finucan listener, and that's where they go for good news, and then people who are digitally native or younger or living in more urban areas where, you know, like, ah, ha ha ha, we saw that on YouTube and RT put up a week later, like, you know? I mean, people surely aren't that kind of blind to these media games, you know. Like, I mean, I buy Sunday Independent when I'm hungover for a laugh, like, you know. You know, I know my dad reads it pretty much for the same reason as well. Like, you know, we can consume their media and convert our reading of it. Like,
Before you make up your mind, see it on YouTube and then buy it.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's even my old fellow would be the same now. You know, he'd be very skeptical about what, and I think a lot of his generation, and I suppose my own or whatever, much more skeptical now because of the net, and kind of going, don't trust them the way we don't trust the other pillars of society that have fallen down as well, and the doctors and the priests and everybody.
There are huge studies and audiences and that have shown that the people who can have critical readings are, you know, there's different readings people have. I think that's absolutely true, and I wouldn't, this old young thing, and like my mother's on the internet, you know.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know the rural urban thing. I wasn't
10 years ago, more so. But
Now, I mean, on smartphones, it's all there, but it still sets the agenda. It still decides what you're talking about. That's where they still, and it still frames the agenda in a certain way. That what way are we going to talk about this? For example, is drugs a police issue, or is drugs an issue of medicine, or, you know, a health issue? And so, for example, Pat Candy's on in the morning, does he invite in doctors, does he invite in policemen? And that frames the entire story.
I think maybe that's kind of what I was trying to get at, maybe, is that, like, the role of kind of radical or alternative media, in one sense, is to contribute to, like, counter-hegemonic movements.
Yeah, absolutely.
So are we all over here having one conversation on Twitter, in Look Left, in Ravel, wherever else, and they're just all over there talking to themselves, basically, is kind of the point I'm trying to make.
But that
discussion about drugs isn't the one that I have, but most people I know are on the internet that I'm on. It might be the one that Marian Finucane has, and that might be the one that's closer to the corridor of Paris, but maybe we're all just circling them from outside anyway.
The actions of William Martin Murphy and Dennis O'Brien, though they are to be heavily criticised, could quite well be likened to those of a host of other players in the game of Irish business. Perhaps the real question, however, is that of our desire to place such financial power so close to our media power. Do we really wish for our media to lie in the hands of business moguls with a penchant only for profit? Is the stifling or lack of representation of a voice of a nation by a wealthy few truly conducive to a healthy Ireland? Honest journalism is an essential element of democracy and equality, and until it is separated from profit, it is difficult to envisage how such a society will manifest itself.
That's all for this week. If you would like to contribute or get in touch, email us at ub1913@gmail.com or visit our website ub1913.wordpress.com. Contributors for this week's show were Jen O'Leary, Shane Fitzgerald, Fiona Duncan and Alan Dunn. Thanks to Connor McCabe, Harry Brown, Henry Silk, James Redmond and Paul Reynolds. Produced by Tom McDermott and Jen O'Leary.